This is Espanglisher, a podcast of musings and chat from a lingua, logo, biblio, anglo, hispanophile. We'll be talking about words, language, and culture. So with no further ado, enjoy. Hi there, and welcome back to Espanglisher. So today we've got a little bit of a Christmas curiosities episode. Now, I do want to stress that from a cultural and religious point of view, we're talking about the culture in England and in Spain. Obviously, other cultures and religions celebrate or don't differently or have their own equivalents. But these are just a few curiosities related to the kind of Christian cultural pagan traditions. You know, in England, it's well, the whole of the UK, you know, it's such a wonderful melting pot of so many different cultures that to speak of Christmas traditions being universal is not the case. But I'm just talking about those traditions that I'm familiar with, which evidently come from the culture that I was brought up in. And yeah, just a few curiosities, similarities, differences between how Christmas is celebrated in England and in Spain. So with no further ado, let's get on to it. The first one I wanted to have a look at was ghost stories. Now, we may not always be familiar with the idea of ghost stories being a traditional part of Christmas, but apparently they were and still are. You're talking about the dead of the year, aren't you? You're talking about the winter solstice. You're talking about the cold. You're talking about people gathering together because there's nothing else to do. And you're talking about the end of the year. Maybe that's the time when we think about those who are no longer with us. Winter, you know, death connected with winter, but also the idea of rebirth, of what's going to come. And we'll talk later about the winter solstice and the Yuletide. But yeah, the winter solstice, darkest day of the year. So we're talking about 21st, 22nd of December. It's a time when maybe you look to the past, you look back, but at the end of the day, you're looking at your past and your present and your future. You know, if you think about the new year, you know, the Christmas Carol, the Dickens Christmas Carol is the epitome of that, really, isn't it? Looking at the past and the present and the future. But one of the ghost stories that I absolutely love is set in the Victorian age, but it's actually a novel by Susan Hill from 1983, which is called The Woman in Black. It's like a gothic horror. Well, it's like in the gothic horror tradition, and it's wonderful. I'm not normally into ghost stories and those types of things, but what happens in this novel is it begins on Christmas Eve, and the central character is, you know, they're all trading ghost stories, and the central character feels bad because he doesn't have one. And then he realizes that he actually does, and he wants to write it down because he's not prepared to tell them at that point. And so the novel is the recounting of that experience that he had. Now, this has been made into a play and into a film. And all three of them, the novel, the play, and the film, have kind of different elements to them. The novel is basically that, is starts on Christmas Eve, and then the protagonist decides to write down his story. And in the play, which is amazing, if you ever see it's on anywhere that you are, I highly recommend going to see it. It's the only time I've actually felt terrified in a theatre. And it's kind of from a different take. the protagonist goes to an actor to see if the actor can help him recreate the story. And in the film version with Daniel Radcliffe, I believe, it's the same story, but it's kind of from a little bit of a different take. And there are a few liberties taken with the text, the original text, but, you know, that's par for the course in any kind of film adaptation. But all three of the versions, the novel, the play, and the film, I loved hugely. And it's just this wonderful ghost story. And so if you're thinking of telling ghost stories at Christmas, that would be one I would go for. Moving on to, we talked a little bit about the winter solstice and Yule time, the tree, the Christmas tree and the lights on the Christmas tree. Now, the Christmas tree is commonly attributed to Germany, the tradition in Germany, and in Scandinavian countries as well. The idea of bringing in the green, bringing in the evergreens, like the midst of winter, bringing in the evergreens, which signify new life, eternal life. You know, even if you think about the Christmas wreath that we have as a tradition, it's a circle, isn't it? It's unending. It symbolizes eternity. And so these traditions were brought into England, at least, in the Victorian age with Prince Albert, who is Queen Victoria's husband. And he brought over the tradition of the Christmas tree. But kind of the Victorians basically have a lot to, I was going to say answer for, but that sounds like a bad thing. They're basically the bringers of what we see as a traditional Christmas these days, I guess. In fact, in Germany, the Christmas tree hangings, the Christmas tree ornaments, one of them was possibly a wafer, like the host, the Christian host, which then got converted into hanging cookies. So make of that what you will. But yeah, they're the candles, the light, all signifying light in the darkness in the middle of winter, the light for the future, you know, and so kind of it makes sense. It makes sense both in the pagan tradition and in the Christian tradition. So yeah, that's one. What about carols? So villancicos in Spanish, and I'm going to start with the villancicos in Spanish, villancicos. So we're talking about a time when laborers or peasants would live in like a country house, a villa being the place where they would live, not a villa like an amazing mansion. Just a simple dwelling. And they were the ones who maybe started with this tradition of coplas. Coplas is a type of music, a type of kind of traditional songs of the peasants, of the laborers. And they became known as the coplas de villancico, as in people who dwelled in the villas. Talking about the Middle Ages here. So maybe these carols, these villancicos, kind of come from the 19th century, but they have their base in far, far earlier. I mean, if you're talking about far earlier and you think about the Christian tradition, you know, when the birth of Jesus Christ, the sing choirs of angels, you know, this the idea of singing, of enjoying, of embracing comes way back from there. And in English, the carols is another interesting thing, because the word in French, carole, C-A-R-O-L-E, was, before the idea of Christmas carols, was just a circle dance with a song. It would be sung in all seasons. You know, this idea of dance, song, community together, whether it was to celebrate a harvest or whether it was to celebrate a holiday, whatever it might have been. This is like as old as time, really and truly. And nowadays we have the tradition, although it's fading, you know, going house to house singing carols. In Spain, after Christmas Eve dinner, because they have their big thing on Christmas Eve rather than on Christmas Day, they would then go to friends' houses for a little glass of anise. They would sing Christmas carols together. So the whole thing basically comes from a sense of community, a sense of everybody together celebrating something together. Oh, and thinking about Spanish traditions, this is one which comes from Catalonia, which is the Caganer. Now, you may have heard of this. The Caganer is a typical figure in Catalonia, and it has spread to other parts of Spain as well. In the nativity scene, the Belén, as they call it in Spanish, which Belén means Bethlehem. So in the nativity scene, you've got this figure who is pooing, basically, squatting. And normally it's kind of hidden. It's in an area of the nativity scene. People put them up in their houses, which is a little bit hidden, maybe behind a rock or a tree or something. And it kind of comes from a tradition, 1700s, 1800s. The idea is that it humanizes the mystery of, in this case, what we're talking about, the Christian tradition, the birth of Jesus Christ. And it's kind of like the human side versus the iconography. It's also like the reality of rural life. Normally in Spanish nativity scenes, you know, they have all of these different figures and different jobs, for example. You know, you've got the carpenter, you've got the farmer, you've got the washerwoman, you know, all of these different jobs are kind of depicted in the nativity scene, the traditional nativity scene. And so they've thrown that one in as well, which I like. one of the interpretations of it as well is that the figure is fertilizing the stable, so kind of bringing new life, allowing life to continue, you know, with fertilization, even if it's with poo. So yeah, that's a curious little tradition here in Spain, particularly, specifically, and coming from Catalonia. Oh, and then we move on to Santa Claus, Father Christmas, versus the Three Kings. So in Spain, you know, the big presents holiday, as it were, when people receive their presents, is on the 6th of January. So the Epiphany, the day when the Three Kings arrive at the stable and bring their gifts. You know, Spain being a traditionally in the past very Catholic country, you know, so it's understandable. Santa Claus exists here, you know. Kids sometimes get gifts from both Santa Claus and the Three Kings, which is a bit much, I think. Yeah, I mean, the Reyes, the Epiphany is still bigger than Christmas for those types of things, for presents, etc. But I do feel sorry for the kids because they have to go back to school the next day. So they have the whole of the Christmas holidays, and then the day after Kings, the day after Reyes, after the Epiphany, they have to go straight back to school and they don't really have time to enjoy their presents. But that's an aside. Also, they have a parade on the night of the 5th of January with the Three Kings. They call it the Cabalgata de Reyes. And you get these people standing with upside down umbrellas, trying to catch all of the sweets that the kings are throwing down. It's become a bit of like the January sales, you know, when everyone goes a bit crazy. So yeah, they have the cabalgata, they have the Christmas parade with the three kings. And the three kings, if you've been naughty, they bring you coal. And they leave the presents in shoes, whereas, you know, in the English tradition, your Santa Claus leaves presents in the stocking. Well, the three kings leave presents in your shoes. You have to leave your shoes out overnight, and they'll bring you coal if you've been naughty. One other funny thing is that, you know, those climbing Santas that people hang out of their windows, as if Santa is climbing up the outside of the wall. Well, here they do that, but they also have the three kings. So you've got these three models of three kings climbing up a ladder, trying to get into the window, and it's a bit creepy. And you always think that, you know, that the one at the bottom is probably going to fall off at some point. yeah, I don't know if that's a mix of the Santa tradition, culturally speaking, but yeah, they do that. I see those a lot around where I live. And of course, Santa comes from the idea of Saint Nicholas. You know, the even though Santa seems a very secular thing, Saint Nicholas was a saint from Turkey, Greece, around that area, patron of children, I believe, among other things. And so it does have that kind of religious base in it as well, even though we see the kind of the Santa Claus side as completely secular. Then moving on to a little bit about food. So in England, it's traditional to eat a turkey at Christmas time. So the turkey was brought back from the Americas, 1500s, around there. And obviously, it's a food which is big enough to feed the whole family. But at the time, it was prized because it was exotic. You know, nobody had seen a turkey in England or in Britain before. And so it was very prized, and particularly for the high class, for the nobility, etc. But over time, it seems that it has become a traditional Christmas dish because it kind of reaches its full size in the autumn and would be killed in midwinter. So it's an appropriate food for this time of year. And, you know, over time, it was after the 1500s, it started to be bred, became more popular. And obviously, again, in Christmas Carol, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, you know, the turkey is the big thing at the end. The big Christmas turkey was very important, although at that time, goose was more common. And in a similar way here in Spain, although, you know, they eat many different foods, you know, one of the big treats at Christmas is seafood. And this can probably be attributed to the fact that on religious holidays, we're talking again about Christian and Catholic holidays, you couldn't eat meat. So this was an alternative to meat for celebrations. And also it's abundant in winter. The best times for seafood in Spain are the months with an R. So you're talking about autumn and winter time. And it was also seen as a symbol of like prosperity, good fortune, which we'll see with some other things as well, further on in the podcast. So yeah, there's a kind of a similar thing, the practical sense of the abundance of those types of foods, and also the symbolization that it was, you know, exotic, it was prized, or it was prosperity. So they would be the main courses, and then we could move on to the desserts, which would be typical. I mean, there are many typical desserts in England and in Spain, or sweets. Let's not say desserts, sweets. You know, you've got your mince pies, which is one of my favourites, and you've got turrón, and you've got in Spain, which is like a nougat, but many different forms of it. Polvorones, which are almond-based and very difficult to eat because your mouth just kind of fills up with paste. But anyway, I'm going to talk about two different Christmas sweets. First one being the roscón, roscón de Reyes. The roscón de Reyes is like shaped like a donut. It's like a big cake that's shaped in the form of a ring, in the form of a circle, and dotted with kind of glacé or crystallized fruit. And inside it, you get haba. And haba is like a bean, type of bean, which was a symbol of prosperity, again, in the Middle Ages. At the end of winter, how the peasants would celebrate, how the working class, the farmers, etc., the country people would celebrate, would be with this cake. And if you got the bean inside, it would be a symbol that you would be prosperous the following year. There's another weird tradition that the person who finds the bean nowadays is called a rey del agua, the king of the bean. And the tradition is it kind of becomes reverse day. So the masters become servants and vice versa. But the following day, they're treated just as normal. And it's kind of morphed into the idea that a person who is not of the nobility, let's say, becomes a fool the following day because, you know, it's clearly not their place and they have to pay for the roscón the following year. But also if you find the figure of a king, one of the three kings, you get to put on a crown and it gives you good fortune, it gives you prosperity again. And curiously, you know, we have this tradition of the sixpence in the Christmas pudding in England. Now, the Christmas pudding is like a sugary, fruity, treacly cake. And obviously, you know, putting a sixpence in there, the idea of a coin is that the person who gets it will have good luck for the following year. But what I didn't know is that actually comes from something, again, in the Middle Ages, the Twelfth Night cake. Now, Twelfth Night is the Epiphany, is the 6th of January. And the person who found the pea, so we're talking about like the haba in Spain on the roscón, it's like a bean of sorts. And in England, in the Middle Ages, it was like a pea. So if you found that, you were king or queen for the night and you would have good luck for the next year. So it actually, this Twelfth Night cake comes from exactly the same thing as the Spanish tradition, which I had no idea of. I only knew about the sixpence in the Christmas pudding. But it's clear that, the good luck side of it is common to both. So I guess with all of these examples, what I've deduced or what I've recognized with this research is that every tradition, all of these traditions, be they Christian or cultural or pagan even, they're all connected and they all come from the same thing. It's about community. It's about gathering together, you know, in the winter. The winter is the time, the dead of the year, when you're speaking about nature and the hope for the year to come, the hope for the coming of spring. It's about death. It's about new life. It's about the human need to kind of ward off death, to hope for the future, to look for rebirth, and our need for community, for celebrating together. So whether religion is a part of your life or not, it's good for everybody. It kind of works on all sides. Again, when we're talking about the European Christian / cultural / pagan traditions, it kind of works for everybody because it's all about death and rebirth, community and new life. And so I think that's all I have to say on all of that. I hope it's been more or less coherent. I've enjoyed looking up some of these things that I didn't know before. And however you celebrate, or even if you don't, I wish you a very happy next few weeks, and that 2026 is a great one. Thank you so much for listening. See you after the break. I'll be back in January. Bye. Thanks so much for listening. Subscribe to the blog, espanglisha.com, for articles, short stories, links, and much more. Until next time, happy Espanglishing!